is how to build an intuition for looking at quantum devices, with the idea that having quantum devices in front of you is going to be a more and more common thing as you move through your career, whether you're an experimentalist or a theorist. And it's a good thing to look at yesterday's announcement of the measurements of inflation, seeing that the microwave background has a nice structure if you look at it correctly. And if you go to the website, which I hope you have, and there's two papers, and the second one describes the experimental construction and the analysis. And it's really amazing if you look at the raw data that we've known about forever, and then you look at how they've taken a set of measurements and combined them to pull out this structure, which if you just looked at the microwave background, you wouldn't think that it could possibly be this clear and beautiful. And of course, the analysis that they go through to prove that this isn't an artifact. So I hope you look at that. But there's an example of a quantum device, a superconducting detector, that allowed them to get this high precision data. And it's important to build an intuition. Feynman famously, although we think about Feynman from points of view of developing mathematical methods, he famously says he doesn't rely upon them. And he has this really complicated story about quantum mechanics is like an orange, which I never got. But he had his own way of having an intuition. And maybe the important part there is to say, well, we're not all going to have our same intuition. But the way to build an intuition is to test it. And one way you test it is to have some simple experiments that you can say, oh, yes, it works this way. And I can take that lesson and move it somewhere else. So that's what we'll do. So we have our neutron interferometer. So as clean and simple of a quantum device as we can imagine, as I can imagine. And we see that if we arrange these three blades perfectly aligned so that we have Bragg scattering in the Lowy direction for all of them, and we have an incoming neutron beam, and we describe a basis for this so that we can talk about the states of the neutron. And of course, what we're talking about is a wave function spread over the interferometer. And so this wave function is going to live over this space. And that's a big space, right? We have a wave function that's spread out over centimeters. And the incoming beam is in a fixed state. And then we described the unitaries for these particular blades. We said that what happened is that at the first blade, we create an equal superposition. So this is the ideal unitary. There's a phase flag here. And I probably should have told you. So the crystal is silicon. That's perfect single crystal silicon. And there's no displacement defects. Everything is good. And you can make big, big crystals that way. Interestingly, it's not what you would buy if you were buying silicon for electronics, right? Then they want the dielectric. Well, we want no displacements. So it's a different crystal growth. And here we have a phase flag, but the phase flag is silica, which is also made of silicon, but it's amorphous. And so there's no diffraction for this. And the only reason we use silica is I want no absorption. All I want is to change the path length. And we described a unitary here. And I threw away the phase that both blades pass through and just kept the one, the difference in those. Here, we said that we have this effective mirror. And effectively, I'm renormalizing. But the way that I want you to think about that is that we're only counting those neutrons we actually detect. And so we throw away the neutrons that go, that leave the interferometer, never reach a detector. So our experiment is those of those neutrons that hit reach a detector, how do they behave? And this blade, of course, is the same as that one. And then we can propagate this through, put our helium-3 detectors here. And now I should get the right answer. And I'm not going to spend the time to multiply a bunch of matrices on a board for you. So, at the output of this, we get this state. And if I look at the two detectors, the intensity at this detector and here is there. So this is the intensity. And this is the so-called O beam and the intensity in the H beam. And you can see that it has all the nice structure we'd like, that if I add up the intensities, they add up to 1. And that says I rotate this phase flag, so we rotate this flag about this point. You can see as I rotate it, the lengths in the arms change. And as I do that, then I can move the intensity from one to the other. And that in this model, the intensities go to 0. And so we have intensities at these two that look like so, where that's phi, this is intensity. And here, the neutrons are monochromatic. So intensity in this case just says how many neutrons reach the detector. Of course, if I had a polychromatic beam, then I'd worry about the energy, but I don't have to do that here. And so this is the H path. Now, if we said that neutron interferometer is the best way of measuring a coherent cross-section, what that means is that I go and I put a sample here. And when I do that, I, of course, introduce another phase. I introduce a phase in this particular path, which is the O path. And so I introduce, let me give myself a little bit more room. I introduce a new phase, which I'll call S for sample. And you can show that this phase is simply going to be added to this phase. You might worry that, hey, I've got this blade in between. Don't I have to count it? And of course, you have to count it, but that everything commutes, so life is good. And so you can propagate this through. And what do you see? You end up seeing something that looks like this. Etc. And so you're your contrast curve shifts over by an amount, phi sub s. And so if you want to measure the contrast, I can't just measure one point, because I won't know that things moved over. Right? So what you need to do is you need to measure the contrast curve, rotating this with and without the sample. Or you need to put in different lengths of sample. Either way, you can end up recording the contrast of this. And remember that we said that neutrons are great because they interact coherently. They scatter off hydrogen, so they're great for looking at light atoms. If I want to look at a piece of steel, so let's say I have steel in my nuclear reactor, and then over time there'll be hydrogen embrittlement, that radiation will cause defects, that those defects hydrogen will accumulate. And I would like to be able to study how much hydrogen there is. Neutrons are the probe for that, because neutrons are transparent. Steel is transparent to neutrons. So a neutron will go through steel like nobody's business. But if it runs into a hydrogen atom, well, okay, that's a big event. And so you can measure very small concentrations of hydrogen. In fact, you can image those by using neutrons, even though you're looking at something as, you know, seemingly dense as steel, which isn't dense, the neutrons. So here we have our contrast measurement. It is, as I said, neutron interferometry is the best way of measuring such pieces. And why is it the best way? Because we have a reference arm. Right? If I didn't have a reference arm, and I was simply sending neutrons through a sample, and I said, measure the phase, well, we wouldn't have an easy way of characterizing what that phase shift is. How do I know that the neutron was going slower here? When I measure it, it has the velocity it has. So that doesn't help us. So it's the best way of measuring contrast, and it's never, never used. And the reason is that neutron interferometry is incredibly sensitive to everything. You can take your neutron interferometer, and you can watch the trucks go by. You can take your neutron interferometer, and you can watch the moon rise. Neutron interferometry is, of course, neutrons have mass. They're sensitive to gravitation. The interferometer is sensitive to temperature, sensitive to vibrations. And so at the end of the week, I'll show you how to use quantum error correction to make neutron interferometry robust so that we can actually use it. But for now, it's still our test bed. Okay, so that's the basis of neutron interferometry without any complexity. So now then, we want to add some complexity to this. And I want to look at what this interferometry experiment is doing in terms of the states of the path degrees of freedom on a Bloch sphere. So we have the Bloch sphere. And our neutrons enter in on just one path. And we can do that really, really, really well, right? Because it says, put neutrons there or don't put neutrons there, right? That's easy. And then the first blade Well, the first blade is, as I showed you last class, a pi over 2 rotation about the y-axis. So we're going to rotate here. And I'm sure that you've seen this, that for a qubit, we can describe rotations in terms of an angle and the axis about which we're rotating. And if you haven't, go through and do a Taylor series expansion of this. And as you do so, if you remind yourself that Pauli's square to the identity, that it's easy to see that this is a general form of any rotation. Okay? So the first blade says, oh, I'm going to rotate by 90 degrees. And we would normally write that down as a pi over 2 rotation about the y-axis. So we make an immediate correspondence, right? Identify the angle of the rotation. And just to be clear, theta is the angle of the rotation. And the direction we're rotating about. And then what happens? Well, we get a rotation about the z-axis. By some amount phi. Let's put it out here. And that's under our control. And then we have this pi rotation. Okay, so the middle blade looks like a pi rotation about y. And so now then I go from about y or x. I think it must be about x. It doesn't make any bloody difference, but it's not bad to get things right once in a while. No, it's about y. So we had this pi over 2, then we have phi about z, then pi about y. So then we're going to rotate over here, okay? Then we're going to give a pi over 2 rotation about y again, that third one. So now I'm going to rotate back up. And this point here, this is in the yz plane, right? So we've rotated by some angle that we don't know, and then effectively I rotate back to being in that plane. And then our detectors, well, that's easy. We measure along plus or minus z, right? And now then we have our ability to measure contrast. In this process, is a famous experiment by Norbert Ramsey called a Ramsey French. And it's a way of measuring the coherence properties, right? Because once I rotate from here, well, here I'm in an eigenstate. Now, if rotated into a coherent superposition of being of the neutron being in those two paths of the interferometer, and while I'm rotating, that state by applying this phase shift, then, of course, that coherence must remain. And so if you look at the traditional experiment by Ramsey, then what he sees is as a function of time, the contrast it decays with some characteristic time, which is usually called T2. That's a characteristic. Phase time. And of course, there are the oscillations, which is the reason it's called a fringe. Yeah? Over here, when I showed you the data, we see the fringes, of course. We don't see a decay in general. And so, if I took this and I continued it for many, many factors of 2 pi, then in general, there isn't much of a decay. And what's the mechanism that would give me a decay? Well, of course, a loss of contrast would mean that we would know which path the neutron took. Right? Contrast says that we have a coherent state. But if I can assign, based upon a measurement, which path the neutron took, then of course we lose contrast. So, anything that would allow me to say, that the neutron took one path or the other. And the most common thing is that this interferometer is moving. Let's say it's moving up and down. If it's moving up and down, you know, if you take a basketball and you bounce it against the backboard, but the backboard's moving, then the backboard's going to transfer some momentum. And it's the same thing that happens with neutrons. We can make it more complicated, but the math is exactly the same. And if let's imagine that the interferometer is just moving up, then you can see that the momentum given to the neutron by the moving interferometer would differentiate those two paths. Right? That in one case it would add, in one case it would subtract. And so then the momentum of the neutron, when it arrived at the third blade, it would have knowledge about which path it took. And if you're going to use language like that, then it must be classical. Right? I mean, if we're talking about a quantum state, we can't use the language that says which path it took. Yeah? So motion does, of course, if there's absorption here. That would lead to contrast, to a reduction of contrast as well. Okay? Good.
Is contrast the same as visibility?
No. That's a good question. So it's similar. But in contrast, what we're asking is how deep are the fringes, and we ignore the dark counts. In visibility, we keep them. Yeah? So it's almost the same, but if you look at the denominator, it's a little bit different.
Yeah? Can you write down?
Let me get further, and then I will. Because in this case, contrast is one. Okay? Good. So now, let's change the problem a little bit so that we can see the effect that was just raised. Here, we said we had this equal superposition of neutrons in the two paths. And we get that by choosing the width of the blade to be exactly right, so that when there's a Bragg scattering event, for that particular energy, there's equal probability that the neutron would exit in either of those two paths. But in general, we can say, oh no, there's not equal probability. And so I can replace this first rotation with a rotation by theta. Instead of going all the way, I'm going to mess up my boards here. Instead of going all the way to 90 degrees, we could instead have a blade that only takes us around 45 degrees, or whatever the angle is, right? And of course, we can write that out because we know the operator, and so this becomes finite thickness blade, for non-ideal blade, we have this general piece. And so now, here, we've rotated down. We can still follow the dynamics. We still have this rotation of phi, because that's given by the silica blade. It's still there. So this is exactly the same. Now, the middle blade, when we machine a crystal, we machine it very carefully, and all the blades are exactly the same. So when I describe the middle blade of my interferometer, in the case where I've made the blade too thin, so it's not the 50-50 beam splitter, how do I describe the middle blade? So that's a good suggestion. It says that, you know, if the physics is going to be exactly the same, then I should use exactly this unitary. But I want to remember that in the middle blade, what we've done is to say that the neutrons that are leaving the interferometer, we're always going to disregard those. So the diagonal is always going to be zero. And then we end up having to renormalize that so that it's still unitary, because of course we're only counting those neutrons that hit the detector. So in fact, because of the renormalization, then as we look at the neutrons that hit the detector, the action of the middle blade stays as a pi rotation. But exactly as you suggested, if I look at the intensity of the signal at the end, it will be reduced, right? So it's reduced, but of course, it doesn't matter, because we're only referencing those neutrons we actually detect. And then the rest of the experiment goes on the same, so that here, we say, oh yes, I'm still going to have this rotation about z, and it goes now like this to here. It's still a pi over 2 rotation, pi rotation. And then I'm still going to have another rotation about y, which is hard to see, but we still end up back where we wanted, and we get to reduce contrast. And let me just show you that. If I could have that board. Beautiful. It's coming. I should be patient. Perfect. Oh, there it goes. Okay, so when you look at this, I describe everything exactly as I did on the board. And then here, I plot out for you the O-beam intensity versus the phase of the phase flag, right? So this is what we want to see, versus here, the probability that we have a neutron transmitted, okay? So that comes out as being that angle, the cosine of the angle squared. And you can see that, of course, if the probability of being transmitted is zero, then there's no contrast. There shouldn't be, right? The probability of transmitted is being zero, so everything's being reflected. Therefore, there's no coherence in the problem. And of course, if the transmission probability is one, we're at the top, there's no contrast because, again, we were only in one path. But in between, we get this nice contrast. And here, we see that as well. This is looking at the H beam. And it's a little bit nicer to look here. So this is the ideal case, looking at the O and H beam. So in this case, O is red. And of course, as I change the probability of the transmission coefficient, then we end up being in either all in one detector or eventually all in the same detector. Yeah. So now here, if I look at this case, the contrast and the visibility are the same. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, well, okay, I know the total number of neutrons because I can add these two curves, right? And I know the depth of modulation, okay? And so everything's good. And the challenge is going to come when this curve is shifted from zero or that curve is shifted from one. Okay? But in this case, although we have this small rotation, right, so the depth of modulation of the system depends upon this angle theta. And so the angle says, how well are we probing this? And so depth of modulation depends upon that. But there's no other loss of information. Everything else is perfectly clear. Okay. Now we'll see another case in a second where it all changes from that. Yeah, please.
How are you guaranteed that you land up in the YZ plane again when you allow data to not be piloted?
It's a good question. And now, what's that?
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah. So the question says, where do you really end up? And we start here and we rotate to some point. That's this theta rotation. And then what happens is I spread out onto this disk. So here I'm saying, what's every possibility given these phase flux? And then forget this pi rotation, which does nothing, right? The pi rotation just moves this disk down here. That's boring. Then we take this disk, and now then we have a rotation about this axis. And you're exactly right. What I end up with, I keep thinking that I go back to having a 90-degree rotation, but I don't. What I go up back to is a rotation, is a disk that looks like that, right? Where this angle here is 90 degrees minus theta. Yeah? So we end up rotating and collecting a piece of it. Yep. Perfect. Thanks. Okay. So now then, I want to look at a little bit more interesting piece. And if we can lose this thing. One of the funny observations about physics is that even for simple experiments, no one actually likes to compute anything. We always like to guess. And I was out with my friends talking about this experiment. And the answers were all over the place. Here's the experiment. I put a magnetic field here. Just in one of the paths, or one of the arms of the interferometer. And the neutron, well, remember that the neutron has spin. It's a spin 1/2. So the neutron is spin up or spin down. And so then there's an interaction of the spin with the magnetic field. And then the question is, what happens? And some answers were nothing. We both have spin up and spin down. All the possibilities are there, nothing happens. Second piece is to say that there's a phase shift. So phi, the curves would move over. And the third thing is that we lose coherence. I won't say who proposed who or how much we were drinking at the time, but in this particular experiment, do you see immediately what the answer is? Yeah.
I mean, assuming that my logic is correct. I see any answer. It might be wrong.
Yeah.
But
still early in the morning. No beer,
it's,
yet, right?
It's early in the morning. Phase shift in both ways would create a loss of coherence.
That's exactly right. So what happens is with this magnetic field, then, of course, what we're doing is we're adding a potential. So the potential is the gyromagnetic ratio of the neutron times the field, right? That's the Zeeman energy of the system. And so if you write down Schrodinger's equation, you get the potential difference. And of course, I need to take and add to that, is the spin up or down? What's the magnetic quantum number of the neutron? And because we're thinking here that it's in the eigenstates. It is in the eigenstates. This will take on values of plus or minus 1/2. This is whatever it is. And this is about 2,000 hertz per Gauss. You can add a factor of 2 pi if you like. So then we can calculate that shift. And what will happen is that during this time, the velocity will be increased or decreased by the wave number associated with that, right? The velocity is going to be h bar k divided by m. So you know, you'll be in good shape. And so you end up having your contrast curve that says, okay, here's the contrast curve without field. And then with field, it'll be slightly changed if mz is equal to plus 1/2, say. And it'll be slightly changed like so. If mz is equal to minus 1/2. And because our detector isn't differentiating spin, then it will look at the sum of those two. And the sum of those two will mean that we have a loss of contrast, right? The sum of those two will put us in a curve that's in between those two. Yeah? And if you look in the notes, it's all laid out for you there. Now here, we show the Ramsey fringe, and we see a loss of contrast with time, because it's difficult for, in that case, a spin, not to learn what its state is. So it gets projected into spin up or spin down, and therefore there's a loss of contrast here. Over here, is this decoherence? Did everyone take, you all took Joseph's course and Andrew Child's course as well? Yeah, okay. And in Joseph's course, did he talk to you about Krauss operators or super operators? Okay, so you know all this. So is this decoherence? So certainly, if I look as a function of field, so if field equals to 0, I would see this. And then if I increase the field, pretend I can draw, I would see this. And if I increase the field some more, eventually I would see that half the neutrons arrive at each of the detectors. And of course, these sets of curves are very different than the sets of curves I would get if I changed this angle, right? Over here, what was happening is we said that I would have a curve. And as I change the angle, then this curve would go like this. Right? Until eventually it ended up here. right? So it's a very different set of physics. So from just turning up the magnetic field, it starts to look like decoherence. But I'm assuming because you haven't jumped up and said, oh yes, this is decoherence, and pounded the table, that you're somehow not quite comfortable calling this decoherence. So why aren't you comfortable calling it decoherence?
Interference seems to come from within the system itself rather than an environmental direction.
So that's right. You say that there's no environment that's leading to this. I might quibble with you later, but I won't now. And then there's a piece which I think operationally would tell us that, oh, you don't want to count this as decoherence, and that we could modify the experiment to return contrast. How would we modify the experiment once I've turned up the field so that I'm at this 50-50 point? What's that? Perfect. You say, okay, what I'm going to do is out here, I'm going to put a spin detector, and then I'm going to measure. I'll do the same in the other arm. And of course, we could do that with helium-3, our helium-3 detectors, trivially, right? I can spin-polarize helium-3. And if I have spin-polarized helium-3, then it better only capture the opposite spin state, right? So we can do it that way. Or I can put a magnet here, and I can scatter this spin state I don't want. There's lots of ways of doing it. For this particular experiment, could I also detect the spin? Could I prepare the spin in the state beforehand? You say, yes, why not? And yeah, because in this experiment, there's nothing which is going to rotate the spin, whether I select it afterwards or I prepare just one element of the distribution. Either way, we would return full contrast. And so this we think about as incoherence, that the signal that we're detecting is a distribution, a classical distribution of outcomes, and we're averaging over this. And if I only look and a set of data, it can be hard to tell the difference. If I modify this experiment, it could be easier. What happens if I turn the magnetic field up from this state? If I keep turning the magnetic field up. Have a look. You'll return contrast again. So that, this is a particular case because there's only two elements of the distribution. Normally, we think of incoherence as having a continuum. But in this case, there's only two elements. So as I keep turning it up, I'll see that the contrast oscillates. It comes and goes. And of course, that would tell you right away, hey, this better not be decoherence. I want to show you one last little piece. Yes. Yeah. Theorists like to pretend that incoherence doesn't exist. Right? It's too messy. But a lot of what we see experimentally has these structures. Yeah.
This reminds me quite a lot of the spin angle experiments.
Yeah.
Is that useful analogy?
Absolutely. So there's a...
So can you repeat that?
I will. So the question was about spin echo experiments. It says, hey, could I remove this influence? So I'll say we had this experiment. I put the field here. And I put minus the field here. So that I speed up one spin state in the first, and then I slow it down in the second. I slow down one spin state in the first, and I speed it up in the second. So this is an echo experiment. And it removes this incoherence. If these two are the same with just the change in sign. And then I said, well, okay, but I don't have to do it that way. I could do it this way. I'll put the field here. And I'll put the same field here. And I'll put a coil here. And I'll rotate the spin. I'll rotate the spin by 90 degrees about the X. So I'll take spin up to spin down to spin up. And this also will give me an echo. And this looks exactly like Hahn's experiment. Okay? So let me then save the rest of what I was going to say for tomorrow and stop here. Are there other questions? Yes?
Yeah, so just to be clear, like here making a measurement for the detector that ignores spin. Think of that as making a measurement for the detector that doesn't ignore spin and then like averaging over those results, right?
That's exactly right. So
okay,
you
theorists think that's decoherence. I can still think of that as decoherence.
No. We'll have to have, so if you'll turn this back on, we'll have to have some beers.
Can you comment also on, you were going to talk about whether there's an environment or not? Do you want to correct that now?
No, let's we'll get to that.
Okay, but you want to think on?
Yep. So, you know, we go through, we look at these dynamics, and it's important to keep track of what we know about the distribution of the system. And the so if I take this experiment and there you go, and I look at increasing the field, we see the contrast go away. At some magic point, it's perfectly gone. And as I add the field higher and higher and higher, of course, the contrast comes back and it's oscillatory. But the piece that we want to see is this one. Whereas if I look at one detector, the O-beam in this case, and I increase the field, then we see that the two spin states get split, and the middle curve is the contrast curve, and of course, it goes away. But you miss a big piece of the physics if you then say, I have this density matrix, the density matrix representing this. You know, density matrix now because we're averaging over two states, right? So a pure state isn't going to do it. Because this information is really there. And so if I was looking at another interaction, let's say I rotated the spin, and then I recombined these things, then here, we could use this to create an entangled state. And of course, if it was decoherent, I couldn't do that.
But all the information is always there.
What's that?
All the information is always there.
Yeah, I mean, it's not different in principle, is it? It's just harder to reverse in the case of decoherence.
Oh, hold on.
It's like impossible.
No. Okay. So then it depends upon what you mean by the word impossible, right? So if I take this spin, I take the neutron and I send it through magnetic material. So now its spin state is being switched. Then I really have decoherence. That information is lost.
That means is actually stored in the state of the magnetic material. You just can't.
Information
is actually still stored in the state of the magnetic material. You just can't access it.
So that's only. I'm gonna object. And I'll show you that I'm an experimentalist. That now then you say, oh, there's some magnon in that material that would know. And I say, no, there isn't a magnon. There's an environment of magnons which have been sharing information. And that information is gone. There's no way you can return it. And there are, you know, if I look at a spin system, let's take a spin system of spin 1/2 particles. We'll talk about this later. And I allow the system, the information to spread out. And we've done the experiment in the lab. We've taken and we've created a coherent macroscopic superposition over 10 to the power 11 spins. And I can show you that I can I can change the sign of time, and we can recover that. And the reason is that there's no phonons in that experiment to screw it up. But of course, once you bring in some continuous degree of freedom like that, then there's nothing you can do, right? So as an experimentalist, it's important to me to keep this separation of these things I can refocus. And these things, the information is accessible and useful to me. And for these things, the information is gone. There's nothing you can do.
But theoretically, you agree that the same thing, even though experimentally.
I don't agree theoretically that they're the same. And I think theorists make a mistake if they treat them the same. In particular, you make a mistake if you treat incoherence as decoherence. We'll continue this.